Thank you. Thank you, President Harold Stassen. Dr. Martin Luther King, Sr., and Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and Mrs. King, Dr. Dahlberg, Dr. Teller, and members of the American Baptist Convention, and my good friend from St. Paul, who is on this stage platform with us tonight, the Reverend Floyd Massey of Pilgrim Baptist Church in St. Paul. And I'm sure there are many other Minnesotans here. It's a rare privilege for me and a high honor to have been introduced by a former Minnesotan, one who distinguished himself in our state as an outstanding public official, a governor, a political leader, a statesman, and one who, in the administration of President Eisenhower, launched our efforts at peacemaking and disarmament. And while it is commonly known that President Harold Stassen of the American Baptist Convention and Senator Hubert Humphrey have different political labels, let it be known that we have worked together in the common cause of what we believe is good government and public service. And I shall cherish for the days to come the generous, gracious, friendly introduction that has been tendered me by this fine man. It's most difficult to follow one who speaks as a prophet, whose words literally are poetic, and whose personality has a touch of the magic, a great leader in America, and one who has stirred the hearts of millions of people in this nation, and today leads a great movement in America for social justice. And I refer, of course, to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. I was present on that day in August when Dr. King told us of his dream of America, the America of his dream. I'll never forget it. And I'll always say most reverently, thank God that it was delivered from the Lincoln Memorial, because it was so appropriate that the great emancipator should once again listen to the words of one who seeks to make the promise of emancipation a living reality. And I find myself as just one of the many in his ranks, trying as best I can in my place and station to do what is called upon us to do that which is just. I said on the way over to this great auditorium that my favorite prophet is Amos. Now, I know the president often quotes Isaiah. And Isaiah, indeed, is worthy of quotation on any occasion. And particularly when one quotes, come, let us reason together. And that's a most appropriate quotation for Washington, D.C., I can assure you. But Amos is the prophet of social justice. And Amos is the prophet who spoke of justice as a mighty river. His simile, his analogy is so moving. And I would quote tonight these words from the scripture, from the writings and the teachings of that great prophet. What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? Really, this is what it's all about. This is why we gather together in meetings such as this. This is what the quest for peace is about. This is what we mean when we talk of human rights and civil rights, to do justly. When I opened up my speech on the Civil Rights Bill in the Senate of the United States, I went to the book of Matthew, and I read from scripture, and I read what we commonly call the Golden Rule, and which we so often paraphrase as saying, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's what it's all about, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. And sometimes I wonder why we make such a big to-do about doing what we ought to do anyway. Today in the United States Senate, I heard one colleague after another speak of his interpretation, Dr. King, of the election and the primary election in Maryland. Each is entitled to his view. But somehow or another, we seem to have let it escape us that really what we should be talking about is how can we learn to love one another? How can we learn to really practice that which we preach, brotherhood? And I asked myself, as I was journeying here today, a bit weary, and in a sense knowing that I ought to really maybe be back at the Senate, but also knowing that it was just going to grind on, I said, why do you do this? Why do you go? Because it is not difficult to find audiences to speak to, even in Washington. And then I realized why I wanted to be here. Because it's a matter of conviction. I believe that my work on this particular legislation, to which you've given so much attention here in your deliberations, is not a political assignment. It's an assignment of conviction. It's an assignment or a commitment of conviction. I have long believed that many people have hidden behind the false standards of what they call states' rights in order to prevent themselves from coming to grips with the real meaning and the requirements of human rights. And I happen to believe that human rights are not law in terms of man-made law. I am one of those maybe old-fashioned political scientists which believes in natural law, divine law, which believes that God did create man in the image of his maker. And so I came here because I do believe in God. And because I do believe in the message of Jesus Christ, and because I do believe in brotherhood, and because I do believe that the most powerful force in the world is love. That's why I'm here. If I didn't believe this, I would resign from my church and save the time and the money. I believe that if one is to participate and be a member of a religious faith, the least that he can do is to believe. And then the best that he can do is to practice it. The practicing is more difficult than the believing. So as I speak to you about peacemaking and peacekeeping, I shall possibly wander somewhat afar from what would be traditionally, what would traditionally follow under that caption. Because to me, peacemaking is, as was indicated in the Peace Award this evening, it is a peace that goes far beyond the international scene, or should I say deeper into the fabric of society. It is the peace of harmonious relationships between peoples and individuals. It is the peace of community life. It is the promotion of domestic tranquility, which is one of the requirements of our Constitution. And I might mention that to the governor of Alabama. Domestic tranquility is a requirement of citizenship and of loyalty in this country. And peace is indeed the respectful relationships between labor and management. It is indeed the respect of conscience, because we in this assembly believe in freedom of conscience. So peacemaking requires peacekeeping. One supplements the other. And the making of the peace assures the keeping thereof. Not long ago, I was privileged to address a group in New York City on the occasion of an anniversary of the pronouncement of the Four Freedoms by the wartime President Franklin Roosevelt. And I think you recall, and I know that Mr. Stassen does, he was in the service of our country at that time, had given up his office of governor. One of the most powerful statements in the war was the pronouncement of the Four Freedoms, just as Lincoln's enunciation of the Emancipation was a significant statement of policy and power in the war between the states. And Franklin Roosevelt said that this nation was pledged from now and to the days ahead and the centuries to come to the fulfillment and the realization of the Four Freedoms. And then he outlined them: freedom of speech, freedom to worship, freedom from hunger, and freedom from fear. And in those four freedoms, I suppose much of the anxiety and much of the concern and the worry of mankind, at least in contemporary society, can be summarized or expressed. Freedom of speech. This is what Dr. Martin Luther King practices as he leads a great movement, nonviolent, the right of petition, as American as the 4th of July, to petition for the redress of grievances. It was on that very significant note that this nation was born. Freedom of speech encompasses all that we know of as political freedom. And freedom to worship, another way of saying freedom of conscience. And indeed, to those of us of this Protestant faith, freedom of conscience is everything. And indeed, to people of any faith, to worship, to think, to be able to have freedom of the mind, to come to grips with the problems that beset us. Freedom of conscience is at the heart of the spirituality of man. So in those two freedoms, we come mighty close to the expression of what I consider is a fifth freedom. And the time is at hand now for the enunciation of that freedom, freedom of dignity. Because if you add up the four freedoms, they come to an aggregate total of dignity. Freedom from hunger. And so many people in the world hunger, not only for food, but for affection. Hunger to be needed, hunger to be wanted, hunger to participate in the life of this world and in the life of their community. Hunger to be a part of that which is their world. And freedom from fear, the fear of the authoritarian state, the fear of the dictator, the fear of disease, the fear of fear, the fear of hate, the fear of hopelessness and frustration. And in freedom of hunger and freedom from fear, we come to grips today, or we define more meaningfully today what we're talking about when we say poverty. So I believe that in these older words, we come to recognize what the modern day struggle is about. And I want to talk to you a little bit about freedom and freedom of dignity. Because the contest in the world today between the totalitarian and the free man is not only over economics. The contest is over the interpretation of man, over man and his relationship to his fellow man and his God. And that which distinguishes these great ideological philosophies or ideological differences is this belief in the spirituality of man. Those of us that believe in freedom see man as something more than an instrument of the state or of another man. Those of us that believe in government by the consent of the governed believe in it because we know in our belief and faith that no man has the right to govern another without his consent. And we believe in that because each man is precious in terms of soul and spirit and divine providence. And the equality that we speak of is not the equality of physical stamina or mental capacity. It is the equality in fatherhood and brotherhood of a spiritual nature. And all the fuzzing of the issue will do nothing to do away with the truth. I hear political men talk about how can you say equal rights and equality when you know men aren't equal. It may be true that men are not equal when judged by other men. But men are equal in terms of the spiritual truths. And that is the equality of which we speak. And those who seek to defend democracy would do well to remember that the strength of democracy is not in its constitutional processes or in its forms, but rather in its commitment and its conviction and in its faith and in its belief of the preciousness, yes, indeed, of the divine spark that is found in every human being. Now, I used to lecture this way to my students. I'd tell them to put their books under the chair for 3 or 4 weeks, and we'd talk about democracy. Because when I'd ask them about it, they'd give me a lot of foolish answers. They'd say, it's the right to vote. And I'd say, why should you have the right to vote? You may vote wrong. They would say, it's the right to assemble. And I'd say, well, why should you have the right to assemble? You may just cause a terrible commotion. Of course, there is an answer. The reason is that each person has a will and a conscience of his own, an individuality, a preciousness. And I, for one, repudiate the ugly word called mass. And I embrace the word called individual. And when we speak of peace or of civil rights, let us identify it with individuals. And when you start identifying these great causes with individuals, we will be more just. Because it is more difficult to be unjust to an individual. It becomes rather easy to be cruel and inconsiderate of impersonal, unknown mass. So I come to you tonight with a message of what I believe is some good news. I know that you would expect me at least to give some report on what's going on in the Senate. Well, what's going on in the Senate is not so important as what's going on around the Senate. While some in the Senate are talking, others in halls and chambers and rooms nearby, within close proximity of the Senate, are negotiating, planning, working, and preparing the day for victory. And I can assure you that victory will crown our efforts. I want this gentleman who has been the recipient of your award tonight to know that the first stage of the Negro Revolution for Social Justice will be won in the legislative halls of the Congress of the People of the United States assembled. It will be won. And it will be won primarily because of people such as I am seeing here tonight. The most significant development in recent years in American public life is the fact that the spiritual leaders, the churches, the leaders of the respective religious faiths have come to understand that the civil rights issue is not political, is not partisan, but it is moral. They've come to understand that it is the issue of human dignity, which is at the very core of our faith. They've come to understand that it's an issue of social justice, of the golden rule. And because this understanding has come over us, this great movement is in good hands. How fortunate we are that this movement is in the hands of men and women that pray and sing and seek to do justice, rather than in the hands of those who are demagogues, or those in the hand or in the hands of those who would destroy the constitutional system of our republic. How fortunate we are. And how wonderful it is to have a great movement like this that enlists the support and the enthusiasm of the young people at a time when young people can become rather cynical and callous. At a time when the world seems so distraught and tense, how good it is to know that your sons and your daughters can take a stand for justice, for humanity, for freedom, for unity. Isn't it much better that they do this than they be taught to hate? Isn't it much better that they are taught to sing than it is that they are taught to be bitter and to fight, and to be cruel? Isn't it much better to have a Dr. Martin Luther King preaching unity than it is to have a political officer preaching segregation and disunity and racism? And let me say to this audience that if America is disunited, if America is torn asunder because of racial tension and strife, because there are those who are unwilling to recognize the truth of human dignity, then America will never be able to be the peacemaker. Because America's strength is not in her military power alone. That is but as General Eisenhower once said, and I'll never forget it, but the sharp cutting edge of the basic strength of the American people. And if the blade, the tough blade of the strength of the American people is torn asunder by corrosion and corruption, and by disunity and disharmony, and by social tension, and by chaos and disorder, then as surely as I stand before you tonight, this nation will have lost the mantle of leadership, and peace will not be for our time or for generations to come. So I commend the religious leaders and their followers, parishioners, and members of congregations who have done so well thus far. But may I assure you that there's more to do, because laws do not settle problems. Laws provide a framework within which you can work out problems. Even if tomorrow morning we could pass the Civil Rights Act as everyone in this room would like us to write it, if we could pass it as Dr. King would want it, as Hubert Humphrey or Harold Stassen, it would not solve our problems. You cannot erase from the countenance of America that has been besmirched with segregation, discrimination for many, many generations. You cannot erase that blotch, that ugliness, by merely the passage of a law. But you can start. A law establishes standards by which we measure men's conduct. A law within itself is an educational instrument. A law provides a framework within which men of reason and goodwill and tolerance can work out their difficulties. And my fellow Americans, either we're going to work these things out within the framework of law, or they will be decided on the streets in blood. They will not go undecided. And someone needs to say what is the truth. There is a great movement and a great stirring in this nation, as there is throughout the whole world. And that movement and that stirring centers around the desire to be respected, to be accepted, the desire for recognition of human dignity. It's to be found in South Africa. It is found in the Middle East and in Africa itself. And it's found in the Far East and in Latin America. And I hope that we who are of democratic faith are not going to let the communist or the extreme right-wing fascist try shortcuts and destroy freedom in the process. I hope that we're going to be big enough and strong enough to recognize that the making of peace is a process. And it requires more courage to be a peacemaker than it does a warrior. And it takes more time to win the battles of peace than it does the battles on the battlefield of war. It takes more time to heal the sick than it does to become sick. It takes more time to obliterate illiteracy than it does to become ignorant. But above all, what it takes is the willingness to begin. And the late beloved President Kennedy, whatever may have been your political persuasion, aroused this nation and called us into action when he said, "Let us begin." And we're beginning mighty late. Because if this nation is to lead in this world, and mark my words, either this nation will lead or some other force will lead, there will never be a power vacuum. There never has been and there never will be. And if this nation, feeling that it leads the forces of freedom and decency, if this nation is to lead, then it must set an example. And just as I've said that the civil rights issue is a moral issue and it is a national issue, let me say it is an international one too. 2/3 of God's children are colored. And while the white man may have not taught them how to live the good life, they have taught them how to kill and destroy. And I submit that unless we start to teach how to love and how to do justly and how to love mercy and how to walk humbly with thy God, unless we start to do what Amos said to do, then the forces of bitterness and strife will triumph. And church people must know this. The affluence of America must not beguile us. It must not fool us into believing that nothing can go wrong, because it can. And more importantly, my friends, we can lose not only ourselves, but we can, as the custodians of decency and compassion and freedom, we can lose this whole mantle of leadership all over the world by what we do at home. You cannot deny the American citizen of color his just rights under the Constitution and then preach self-determination abroad. You cannot deny a man the right to enter a place of public convenience and accommodation here in America and then denounce the communist for what he does to others in faraway places. You cannot engage in brutality and violence on the streets of our cities as people seek justice and then somehow or another lead the forces of freedom and decency in far-off places in other parts of the world. Why is it, my fellow Americans, that we seem to be able to judge so well far distant places, but to do so poorly at home? And I say this is even true of in our own country. The problems of bigotry and intolerance and discrimination are not merely in Alabama or Mississippi or the South. If the governor from Alabama has taught us one thing, he has taught us that basic appetites and emotions of prejudice can be found in every section of this nation. Every section. So we are not the one to point the finger. The truth is that we need to examine our own souls and judge not, lest we be judged. So the making of peace starts with oneself. President Kennedy said it was a process in that famous speech at American University on June the 10th, and it is. It's a process, and the civil rights movement is a part of that process. And once we pass the law, then the process comes of trying to equip the communities of America to do something about this law, to change attitudes, to change practices. And may I say most respectfully that one of the things that we in the Senate have done with the amendments that we are contemplating to the Civil Rights Bill is to incorporate into that bill more local and state and voluntary responsibility. We do not do away with the ultimate authority and power of the federal government. But I do not want to see these laws only administered from Washington. I want to see men who are in the county courthouses, the mayor's offices, the governor's offices, men and women who are entrusted with responsibility of government and have taken an oath to the Constitution of the United States, live up to that oath and do justice in their community. And the church leaders have the responsibility for the making now of the peace of mind, of attitude that is required to make a law effective. And what else must we do? Well, there are the poor amongst us. Poverty is nothing new. We've had poverty as long as we've had recorded history, and I suppose before it. What is new about poverty is that it's no longer necessary. No longer does man need to pray as a forlorn hope, so to speak, for daily bread. The possibility of bread for every table in the world is here. Science and technology has made that possible. In fact, one could well examine current policies of our own government as to whether or not we ought to be paying people not to produce at a time when humanity hungers. This might well be worth looking into. We do live in a miracle age. I remember one of my favorite quotations from Scripture. I believe it was in the book of John, Greater things than I have done, ye shall do also. I'm not a good preacher. My scripture isn't always good, but I think I know what it means. And I want to say that greater things we can do. We can heal the sick. We can feed the hungry. We can lead the blind. And we can restore sight. We literally can save life. We can feed the hungry of the world. Poverty is not new. What's new is that man now has the knowledge and the resources and the know-how to do something about it. And what else is new? As the youngsters say, I'll tell you what else is new. We just discovered that we still have the poor with us. And interestingly enough, some of us had forgotten it. And for Christian people to forget the least of these is a violation of our faith. We, above all other peoples, have a responsibility to be concerned about those who through some misfortune are not able to take care of themselves. And we, above all others, ought to help people learn how to take care of themselves. And poverty, the poverty that I speak of is not merely the poverty of the purse. In this modern day and age, we learned how to write checks. We do know how to give relief. My, yes. And it's no answer to the problem of poverty. It is a temporary palliative. Yes, it is an act of compassion, but it is not just. Because the poverty that I speak of is not only the poverty of being poor of money, low income, but it is the poverty that comes from years and years and years of denial of opportunity, of being cast aside, of being told, take your place and stay there, of being not wanted, of not being employable, of being lost in the technological revolution that grips this nation. It's a poverty of the spirit. It's the poverty, yes, that can come from disease, physical disease, organic disease, and mental illness. And we need to attack this poverty in its fullness with every weapon at our command. An all-out war on poverty calls for something more than just loans and grants. What it calls on, first of all, is to try to enlist into the total life of the nation everybody that wants to be in it. There is no room for a conscientious objector in the war on poverty. Not one. And I don't believe that you can really have many civil rights if you're left in the backwash of modern society. I think it was that comedian, Dick Gregory, who had something to say about that was all right to be able to sit at a lunch counter, but what good did it do you if you didn't have a dime for a cup of coffee? Now, I'm not sure that that is the way that I would feel. I think it is important also to be able to sit at the lunch counter even if you can only get a free glass of water. But believe me, but it goes to, it should be said, too, that it is important for one to be able to participate. And isn't it interesting that in America, those who are asking for their rights are not asking for them so that they can move away from the society. They're wanting to be in it. The American Negro is not asking to be separated from us. He's asking to be a part of the brotherhood of this great republic. And that is the only way that you can have peace, because a house divided against itself cannot stand. So those that preach segregation, those that say that we'll do this for that group and we'll do this for the other group, they divide our house and they weaken us in our capacity and ability to make the peace. Now, making the peace also is on the international front. And there are men and women in this audience, and indeed the gentleman that introduced me could well tell you more about it than I can. We have created instruments of making the peace and keeping the peace. And our own country has done much about it. And I did not come here tonight to denounce foreign aid or to complain about how much we're spending. I do not travel under false colors. I do not happen to believe that the United States of America is going to go bankrupt because it shares with somebody else. Now, it isn't perfectly true that we can argue over the administration of these programs, and we should. And we should insist upon efficient administration, as efficient as people can be. And we are not computers or machines. But I remind you that whatever we do now in the world, we do with people that are strange to us in faraway places. People who are hundreds of years behind in what we call civilization. And nevertheless, those same people which may not be able to create a new world or a better world overnight can destroy it. The power of the people can destroy a world even if it cannot save it. So I come as one who advocates these great works of peace. The Food for Peace program that today feeds millions of people throughout the world with the abundance of our agriculture. And while Mr. Khrushchev and others can talk about their cosmonauts, and they can talk about their massive great programs in industry, they can't talk about a family farm, and they haven't been able to find out how to create enough food to feed their own. And food finds a noble place in our faith and in our scriptures. And food is an element in peace. And Food for Peace, which is a bipartisan program, but which is the exemplification of the generosity of the American spirit, is at work for peace. The Peace Corps, putting young men and women to work to use that youthful vitality and enthusiasm for good works. It's effective. International health programs for peace. For the first time, we're waging international war on cancer, exchanging information to do away with the killers of humanity. Cultural exchanges, so we find out more about one another, so that we learn about each other. These are some of the steps in the process to peace. And we've had also great voices of peace on the political or on what we call the public scene. The United Nations stands today as man's most noble effort in terms of an international instrument for the making and the keeping of the peace. And the president of your convention was one of the authors appointed by the late President Franklin D. Roosevelt, was one of the authors of the Charter of the United Nations. And that charter today is an instrument of peace. So peace is our business, and what more noble work is there? I want to see the UN, yes, strengthened. And I want to see the UN with its peacekeeping operations. And I want to see the American people embrace it. And I have little time for those who mouth the simple slogans of get the U.S. out of the UN and get the UN out of the U.S. Whether they know it or not, as they proclaim their super-Americanism, they are saying exactly the same words that the propaganda organs of the Kremlin mouth day in and day out. The United Nations is an effective instrument if we put it to work. But it's what we say and what we do within that UN. And it will do us little good to complain about the fact that there are so many representatives of little countries. What we need to do in the UN is to do justly. What we need to do in the United Nations is to exemplify day after day our belief in human dignity. And the best way to do that is to have the United Nations, which is located in the United States, be like a mighty camera, constantly taking a photograph of the social, economic, and political practices of this great democracy. And if our practices are right, if our image is clear and clean, we have no worries. And that's why when we talk about the making and the keeping of the peace, we start with ourselves in Birmingham and Minneapolis, in Atlantic City and San Diego, in Chicago and Montgomery, because what we do there for our own and to our own will be more revealing than anything that we can say to anyone else. It is that which we do that speaks louder than that which we say. So making of the peace is indeed healing the sick, feeding the poor and the hungry, and teaching the illiterate. It is waging the war on illiteracy and ignorance, and it is elevating to a high pinnacle and a high plateau God's finest creation, man. And when we treat one another with the respect which our faith and which our political traditions would require of us, I have no doubt but what the 20th century can be known not only as the century of science and technology, but more importantly as the century of dignity, freedom, dignity, and justice. Thank you very much.
Standing for our benediction.